everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for my favorite subject, food. On this show, it's all about food. Thank you for joining me. It is September 24th, 2013, and welcome to autumn. I love the seasons. I love the changes, especially here in New York. I was away in California for about 3 weeks, actually, and it was absolutely beautiful. We left the day it started to rain, and I don't usually have that good timing when I'm traveling, but it was great to get back to New York and smell that fresh, clean autumn air. Do you know what I'm talking about? That cool, delicious change of season. How does the planet know that we're changing seasons? Well, I guess it has something to do with the change of the distance between the sun and the planets and everything else going on, but I love it. And the great thing about the changes of seasons is the opportunity to enjoy different foods. Now, here it is 2013, and many of us have access to just about anything we want at any time, seasonal or not. But I really like to go with the seasons. It's nice to have a change. It's nice to get food when it's at its peak perfection in terms of locality and seasonality. And you learn to appreciate food that much better when you don't have it in front of you all the time. It's all about making things special and extraordinary. But we're going to get to extraordinary in just a few minutes. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what I experienced while traveling. I know I get a lot of questions about how to eat when traveling, and I have to admit I'm a human. I am not perfect, and although I try to do the best I can, sometimes I do falter, and whereas the food that I think is not exactly what I want or is as healthy as I want is probably healthier than most people. But while traveling, I do, especially in this particular instance where I didn't have an opportunity to prepare my own food very often, we would be eating out. And when you eat out, unless you're really super, super vigilant, it's really hard to avoid the evil three, sugar, fat, and salt, or sugar, oil, and salt. And many restaurants tend to use a little too much of those things, and I can feel them. I know there have been some studies out recently talking about is salt good and is salt bad, and all I have to say is when you're not eating a lot of it, and then you get food that has a lot of it, you feel the change in your body. It can't be good. I know I wake up the next morning and I have dark circles under my eyes. It's not a pleasant thing. And it's so great to come home to my sanctuary here, my food sanctuary, and see all my friends, my herbs and spices, all organic, and start to purchase the simple foods that I love and nourish my body and kind of cleanse. So it's great to be home. It's great to be eating the way I like to eat. And although I did enjoy my trip, and it wasn't a vacation, it was work. And that's another thing. When you're traveling and you're not eating the way you want to, you are more susceptible to all those little bugs and viruses out there. And, yes, I succumbed. I got a cold. And it was quite unpleasant, but the good thing is, I think because my immune system is in a pretty good place, I got over it in about 2.5 days. And one thing I'm really vigilant about is green juicing. I haven't talked about green juicing in a long time, but I juice every day. And when traveling, challenging, very challenging. But fortunately, I was in an area where there were a number of whole foods. Not that I'm giving a plug for Whole Foods, but I do like that store for a lot of different things, and more of them are including juice bars, so I was able to have my daily fix, and it really made a big, big difference. Okay, let's get to the fun part. I'm going to bring on my guest, Alan Roediger. He's got a new cookbook out called Extraordinary Vegan. He's a writer, food designer, blogger, and public speaker. He has served clients as a private chef in the United States, Europe, and Australia. Raised in Mexico City, he acquired a taste for exotic food early on and soon developed a passion for flavor and beauty that drives his diverse creative culinary style. He's passionate about empowering people to make smart choices in what they eat and enjoy eating well at home. His cookbooks, Omega-3 Cuisine, Speed Vegan, and Extraordinary Vegan, showcase his ability to bring health and pleasure together in a wide range of dishes that are simultaneously sophisticated and accessible for the home cook. And Alan is my friend, although I've never met him in person. I love talking to him, and I think He's probably been on this show as a guest more than any other person. So let's welcome Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Karen. It's good to hear your voice.
It is good.
It's been a long time.
Just like old times.
Just like old.
And one day maybe we'll meet in the middle somewhere and make that incredible, sophisticated and accessible and extraordinary delicious meal.
Fantastic. Sounds good to me.
But right now, let's just talk and dream about it.
All right.
Right. So before we get to the book, let's talk about – I only want to talk about good things.
Smart move.
Because I know you're really good.
Things. They're already done.
You're really good about talking about the joy of all the good things that are on this planet. And a lot of people focus on the evil. I don't want to do that. I don't like doing that. So we've just turned into fall, and throughout, I think, human existence, although we may not have a lot of documentation on it, people celebrate the seasons, they celebrate the harvest, being thankful for the food we have. And this is kind of a time, a harvest time. And I know in the Jewish holidays, I'm not a religious person, but I was raised Jewish, and I know all the holidays and like celebrating anything that has to do with great food. And this particular week is the holiday of Sukkot, where it's all about celebrating the abundance of food, especially with root vegetables and the fruits that are coming out in this season, apples, pears, sweet potatoes, carrots, root veggies. And there are a lot of different harvest celebrations. Do you have any favorite harvest celebrations?
Yeah, the wine harvest.
Wine harvest.
I've really never experienced the harvest before I went to Europe. I grew up in Mexico, and we basically had the dry season and the wet season, and things grew out throughout the whole time. It was a very temperate climate, so you got pretty much everything. There were a few things that only grew in certain seasons, but I was just vaguely aware that you couldn't get mangoes except a certain time and things like that. Then I went to Switzerland, and I got there in late September. I was going to college there, to your American college, and they had, right off the bat, they had this this harvest, and it was of Vindimia, the harvest of the wine, and they had new wine, and they had roasted chestnuts on an open fire, like the song, but like really,
yeah, right,
like
really
there,
roasted on a fire,
right? You can
smell
it in the street, and they roll up a little cone of newspaper and stuff them in there, and you pop them open and. Things like that. It was a great harvest.
We actually do have that here in New York City. The street vendors sell
the Italians.
Roasted chestnuts in a little paper package.
Yep.
And it's one of the few things that I enjoy from a street vendor. It's kind of hard to get it anywhere.
Yeah, well, if you don't roast it yourself, which is a whole project, you have to trust them to do it. And they had like one of those 50-gallon oil drums cut in half and build a little fire in there, and they had a little grate, and put them on there.
Well, the thing about harvest holidays, and as every culture has them, every religion has them, we've been celebrating these things all throughout, I think, our human existence, because food is so important, and it is definitely worth celebrating. And it's worth celebrating with wonderful, whole, freshly prepared recipes, which I think is something we're all working on getting back to.
I know I am. I don't know if you saw recently that basically everything that's processed has corn in it, and now corn is threatened. It's first of all, it's GMO, and it's got stuff in there, BT toxin or whatever they put in there to kill the insects or repel the insects, plus the Roundup Ready, whatever that gene is. Poison me, I won't die. So it's kind of, you really got to get back to cooking your own food because you can't trust the food system.
I want to think that we have a pretty good government, but there's a lot of things that they could do a lot better, tremendously a lot better. But the thing is they follow, to some extent, what the people want and what the people are doing. And it's really up to us to set a standard. It's really up to each one of us as individuals to support the products we believe in and demand the products that we want. And I want to think that there's a food movement that's happening. I would like it to go a little faster. But you're right about corn. I heard something really wonderful that in California, they used to grow a lot of sugar beets, and then at some point cane sugar from Hawaii and other places kind of took over. Excuse me. But now because corn is used a lot as a biofuel, and I don't want to go into the pluses and minuses just now about biofuel, but maybe I will in a moment. They're growing, they're bringing back their sugar beet production for biofuel instead of corn. It's supposed to be a little bit more sustainable. Anyway.
Don't restart on that one.
I'd rather we move toward more public transportation, walking a lot more, and minimizing our energy use, and saving the delicious foods for eating. How's that?
You had me at delicious foods for eating.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the word vegan and all of the adjectives that are put next to it to describe what kind of vegan we want to talk about. And let's start with extraordinary vegan. What does that mean?
Well, extraordinary, you know, first of all, every single person is extraordinary. You know, because there is really no such thing as ordinary. Ordinary means like every other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really there is no such person. Every single person is extraordinary. Every single act is extraordinary. But then there's making it extraordinary, making it beyond just what people perceive as ordinary, and make it something really special. And that all it takes is just a couple of steps. You know, adding a little something to your food that makes it surprise you, to make it something different, and taking the time to do it right.
To get your attention and to shut your mind off from all of the ridiculous things it's saying to you and have you wake up in the moment and go, wow, there's something exciting on my tongue.
This is really good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's, and it doesn't take much. And I think that's what, you know, what's important for, if you're trying, like me, I'm trying to get more people cooking and eating at home, because I know, first of all, that things will go better in general in your life if you do that. I mean, your relationships will be better if you turn the TV off, sit at a nice table, and eat something that does stop you and go, wow, this is really good. Thank you for making this for me. You know, something like that will definitely influence the rest of your day, the rest of your existence. And also, it happens to be something dear to me, which is food. But I think that the more people are involved in making their food, the more they'll become aware of how good it can be, and the more they'll demand those whole grains and whole beans and whole foods. And also, if you involve your kids in the process, they're much more likely to eat something they might not eat otherwise, if they had took a part in preparing it. Or if you grow food, if they're in the process of helping you grow the food, they're much more likely to eat something like a vegetable, and less likely to say, no, what I want is I want to go to McDonald's and get a hamburger.
I'm saying it all the time. You've probably heard me say it. People need to find their kitchen. And I love the idea of eating at home, making food. And there's something really romantic about people getting together and eating a lovely meal. And unfortunately, there's a lot of grocery stores today and other stores that will prepare a lot of foods for you that you can bring at home and serve at a holiday dinner, a dinner party. And sometimes it really saves time and it's convenient, but a lot of people depend on these things. And I think you really lose a big chunk of what eating around the table is all about when you're not preparing the food.
Absolutely. And there's a sense of community and a certain sense of gratitude and a sense of wonderment at the food itself that you just don't get when you go out and buy it at a store. You just take it, and then usually you eat it in front of a lit screen of some kind, and everybody has their own lit screen at the table.
Oh, please turn off those screens.
And we've all done this, but it's something that you know. It's not like blaming the people for looking at the screens. It's more like trying to entice them back, and the way to entice them back is to have something more interesting than what's on that screen.
It has to be
more interesting.
Can you imagine people around the table and they're all texting each other what they think about the food?
Classic. Well, that's what you said that, you know, there are two sounds I like when I cook for people. There's either the people going and saying, "Did you do this incredible?" and they're going back and forth about it, or the other one, which is actually my all-time favorite, with the whole room just goes silent and people are they had this whole conversation going, and then they start eating, And then nobody's saying anything. They're just eating and eating.
Yeah.
You can tell that they're just stunned, and they're just enjoying the food. That's my favorite sound of all, the silence that falls over the dining room. And that only happens when somebody, whether it's me or somebody else, makes the effort, takes the time, puts the love into it, puts the attention there, and makes something. And it doesn't really have to be, you know, I'm not trying to turn people into master chefs. A chef is a job description, first of all. I know chefs that couldn't cook to save their lives. And I know people who cook amazingly that will never be a chef because it's just somebody who runs a kitchen.
Yep.
And you don't have to be that to make something that will do that, you know, do that trick to make people just go silent and eat and go, wow, this is incredible. Anybody can do it.
You wrote in the introduction of your book, attention is the currency of love.
How did you feel about that? Did you agree? I did kind of explain it.
Of course.
But isn't that it?
It is. We all need to pay attention. You know, when we invest our attention, when we invest our time in anything, we reap so much more from it.
That's right.
I'm tired of these sound bites on the news. I'm tired of music that is trivial that people throw together without much attention, without much art, without much love.
To fill in the space that is only there because people are not paying attention.
Yeah.
If you're paying attention, life is fascinating. Everything, I mean, being at a bus stop, being in an airport, being in a normal, you know, kind of frame of mind, you would be thinking, oh, this is boring. When will this be over? When can I get on my plane? When will I get there? But when you're paying attention, everything is alive. Everything is moving. Everything is exciting. It's a beautiful life.
And it's only a beautiful life.
When you put your love, which is your attention, that you know, when you invest it in the world around you and in yourself and in the people you love, your life becomes very rich. Very, very, very rich.
Yeah. And
by the way, I have to take issue with something you said earlier because I was listening.
Oh.
You said I'm not perfect.
Yes.
Actually, you are. This is the way you're supposed to be.
I'm extraordinary
and
perfect.
And you're doing it perfectly. We are experiencing machines. We are feeling machines. And the more you feel, the more you open up and appreciate what's around you, what's being literally given to you in the moment, the more you're expressing the nature of what you are. It's not a question of never making mistakes. You know, it's a question, because that's how you learn.
Mm-hmm.
We all make mistakes, but that's not an issue of perfect versus imperfect. Perfect is the one who makes mistakes and goes, oh, wow, I shouldn't have done that. And then next time maybe you don't, or maybe you do it again. You go, oh, I did it again. And eventually you don't do it anymore because you learned. I mean,
that's
how cool is that?
That's a good point. You know, I know a lot of us, especially us crazy vegans, like to think that we are invulnerable to some extent. And then when we get a cold or we get advanced ovarian cancer or whatever it is.
What are you, right. I got a giant kidney stone a few weeks ago.
You did not?
Yeah, 7 millimeters. They had to go in and take it out.
Oh, so you didn't go through the pain of getting it
out?
Oh,
I went through the pain, but when they finally realized, they did an MRI and saw that it was 7 millimeters. They go, well, you know, the guy says, I was at the ER, and he said, well, you have two choices. You can try to pass this on your own, and maybe it'll take, I'm going to say probably a week to a month, and it'll hurt like this the whole time. And maybe you'll pass it, and maybe you won't. Or we can knock you out, and I'll just go in and take it out and put a stent in there, and in a week it'll be over.
Right.
I said, okay, well, how about B? Option B. So that's what they did.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that was probably building for most of your life.
No, I had one 15 years ago.
Oh, you're kidney stone prone.
I guess so.
What are you doing about it?
Morphine.
People are concerned occasionally about kidney stones, and unless you're not prone to kidney stones, you don't really have to worry about it, but oxalic acid is brought up a lot in spinach and rhubarb and those things, and do you watch it at all, or you're just proceeding on?
Oxalic acid, well, you know, how do you get it out before you eat it, or do you just not eat
it? Well, you just avoid the foods that have a lot of it.
Like spinach and rhubarb?
Like spinach,
what else?
And rhubarb. And I'm not sure off the top of my head. You'll have to Google it. But
tell me kale isn't among those.
Well, not really. It has some, not as much as spinach. And again, everything I've read says if you're on an animal food-centered diet, you're more prone to it. And maybe you were building all those stones, you know, in your
I've only been vegan for 5 years.
I think you were building even that stone.
Okay, so we can blame it on
a long time ago on your prior life. These things will happen every night.
You know, I'm okay. I'm okay with vegan not being perfect. You know, I'm okay with with that not being something that just fixes everything.
I think those were old. That was an old stone.
Well, 7 millimeters. It's been building for a while.
The other one,
I passed no problem. Well, I wouldn't say no problem, but pain, but it happened, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, the point is, we are human. We are perfect.
Thank God.
And we experience all kinds of fascinating things in our bodies. And by eating a healthy plant-based diet, we can minimize some of those risks. But we're not going to avoid life's experiences.
No, and I don't want to. I like my life experiences.
Okay, I like most of them, but if I had a choice, I wouldn't.
When they're happening, but afterwards, you definitely are several steps ahead of where you were before it started. Admit it. I mean, it's always, you know, it's not something you go, oh, I know what, I'll go have a kidney stone, or I know what, I'll, you know, fall down and break something. No, you never do that. But
I want to experience
that. But there's always
that.
When it's over, you're always several steps ahead of where you were before. It always gets better.
Well, we are never the same person. Every day we
That's
are
right.
changing, and every experience makes us different.
That's right. And it goes into the information that gets passed on. It really does.
All right, let's go back to the beginning of your book. The very beginning, you have a lovely foreword by Dr. Neil Barnard. I'm going to have him on my program next month. And that was really lovely that he did that for you.
I know. It was very, very nice of him.
And
he's a nice guy.
And he, in one of his very first sentences, he was giving a number of different examples of people who experienced tremendous physical improvements by changing their diet. And the first thing he mentioned was arthritis. And I have my own personal story, and I just know from firsthand experience that when you put toxins in your body, your joints are going to hurt. And it takes a while to get the toxins out. Now, I experienced it through chemotherapy, and doctors won't even acknowledge that the chemotherapy causes arthritis. They'll tell you that chemotherapy cures arthritis, but they don't get it because I went in totally clean, arthritis-free. I got the chemo, and then after I finished the chemo, I woke up in the middle of the night and in the morning with pain in my hands and feet, and I went back on chemo. The pain went away. And then I got off it, and the pain came back, and it took literally a year for it all to go away, and I know that that's what caused it. I know it's an anecdotal story that doctors will just go, oh, you're just one case, but it's true.
And the other big takeaway is that doctors really don't know everything.
They're perfect, but they don't know everything.
They're perfect human beings. They fail frequently. They do what human beings do very well.
So the point is, people think when they're aging, aches and pains are natural. They are not. You can feel great for a long, long time. And all you have to do is be an extraordinary vegan and eat all these delicious foods that are in this book that we're going to be talking a little bit more about during this hour.
Anti-inflammatory, non-inflammatory. The combination is pretty good.
Right.
All that dairy and stuff is very inflammatory.
Very inflammatory.
and acidifying, which invites disease. I mean, I've read that disease does not fare well in an alkaline environment.
Right. It just doesn't like being there. So it
loves sugar.
Sugar, yeah. Okay, let's talk about some bizarre ingredients. I came up with that word, bizarre. I'm putting it in air quotes here. I find that more and more we're in some ways dumbed down with what we're eating. Big agribusiness, they're growing less and less variations of food. They'll grow one kind of potato, one kind of rice, and grow a lot of it because it's more efficient and cost effective. It's not that great for the environment. It's certainly not good for us. And there's a wide range of all kinds of food out there, so many different varieties of potato, rice, every grain. There's a gazillion spices and herbs, and we don't know anything about them. And then people can get frustrated when they open a cookbook and say, oh, I don't know what this is. I don't know where to get it. But we really are meant to experience all of these things. And you have a number of interesting ingredients in your book that aren't in your average everyday American cupboard.
Like absinthe?
Isn't that something that kind of can kill you, absinthe? Or
no, you know what? Here's the thing that doesn't get out is that absinthe was made illegal, not in Switzerland, but everywhere else, not because it had some kind of weird psychedelic poisonous kind of thing in there. It's strong. I mean, it's 110 proof. So that in that sense, yeah, be careful. It's twice as potent as your vodka. But it had wormwood in it, and they made up this whole thing of that wormwood is poisonous, and actually it's a tonic herb. It's something that's used in old medicine. And it was something that the pharmaceutical industry, which was just beginning to flower, didn't like, that people were using natural cures. So that's how they made up this whole story. And, of course, people did get blind drunk on it because it is 110 proof and not everybody knows what they're doing. And so they would get blind drunk and they would do stupid things. But the same could be said of any other alcohol that you abuse.
Right.
You know, binge drink, and that happens.
So what does
but
it taste
it wasn't,
like?
It wasn't absinthe. It tastes a little. It's made of, anise and green fennel and wormwood. And other herbs, you know, it's like an herb tincture basically, but it's mostly tastes like fennel, kind of like fennel.
Yeah, licorice-y
but
flavor.
But it's not like anisette or Pernod. Those are straight fennel. This one actually has it has a little bit edge of bitter because of the wormwood, and it's got a little bit of so it's an interesting flavor.
I drank a lot of Pernod when I lived in France.
Pernod was what they were left with after absinthe was removed.
Pernod and water, a little pastis.
Yeah, gets
as
a
we called it.
Colored. Yeah.
I'm getting
it
nostalgic
does the
now.
Same thing. You pour water in, it gets milky. It's the same stuff.
Gets milky white.
Yep.
Okay.
Wonderful drink in the summer with ice.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
No
I
sugar
have...
is required. The traditional thing, they put a little sugar cube on that. Little looks like a small cake spatula, you know, like cake server. The little holes in it, and then they pour the absinthe over the top, and it melts, dissolves the sugar, and it goes in, and then they use the
sugar. Do you have somebody there that wants to say something on the show?
No, they just you know, every now and then an animal will walk by, and they have to set the parameters of, you know, where deer are allowed and where they're
not. I thought the animal wanted to say something. The dog.
They always want to say something, but they're really not too articulate. Sometimes it's hard to figure out what they're trying to say.
Right. You know, speaking of dogs, I wanted to mention before when we were talking about paying attention to food. Dogs eat in a certain way, and it's appropriate for them. They kind of take big chunks and gulp it down. They're not into chewing. They're into eating quickly. And humans are not supposed to eat that way, and yet I see humans eat like dogs all the time.
Well, you know the secret, right?
What?
If you allow some air, you see when people taste wine, like at a wine tasting, they'll take a sip, and they'll swish it around in their mouth.
Right.
And then
little air.
Then they'll open their lips just a little bit to suck in a little air, and then all of a sudden, all those little notes that have gone all over your mouth suddenly come to life, and you can taste everything. If you drink something without opening your mouth, look, you don't taste it at all, or you get a very vague sort of taste. But if you drink it slowly and you have a little air in there, you get an explosion of flavor. Even water tastes better if you drink that way.
With a little air.
Yeah.
Well, because most of our flavor is from smell, so I guess that's
right.
Allowing us to smell the food.
Flavor is the four or five, depending on who you believe, or six tastes, and then the olfactory, which has got thousands and thousands of notes that you can use, and combine those two together, the aroma and the taste, you get flavor.
Okay, so back to bizarre ingredients.
Oh yes.
Or not really bizarre ingredients, but there's a lot of different things that we can flavor food with. There's curry, for example. You have a garam masala in some of your recipes, I believe. And there's a lot of different mixes like that. And even if it has the same name, if a different brand makes it, it might taste different than somebody else.
Different brand
else's.
And also different origin and different parts of India. Have a different mixture. The South Indians is much sweeter, and they use star anise, and they use things that in the North they don't use at all.
So here's a not-too-long story about just that.
Okay.
So we have some Indian stores around here, and occasionally I try something new, and I bought a Madras curry, and I bought a lot of it. And then I discovered I didn't like it because it had it was a little too sweet.
That's the South.
And it just didn't work. And then recently I was out and about somewhere, and I had this carrot puree that was used as a spread for the bread in the restaurant. And a light went off, and I thought, I want to try that Madras curry with carrots. And it worked beautifully. Because the carrots, I guess, were sweet, and it worked with it.
Yep.
So you have to figure that out, right?
You really just have to figure it out. This is, you know, we do come with an owner's manual, but it's not written. It's called Feel Good, Feel Bad. If you get it right, it feels good. If you get it wrong, it feels bad. And you have to kind of learn.
I learned a long time ago when I was in a painting class about color and intensity and how a particular color can look very different when depending on the background of the color. So if you put a certain color red on a certain color blue and then put that same red on a different color green, you will swear they're not the same red color.
Yep.
And it was fascinating to
context.
Me. Context. And so the same thing is with herbs and spices and other flavorings where you might try something and think, this is the most disgusting thing I've ever had, and then mix it with the right foods, and it becomes extraordinary.
Yeah. Or sometimes, like in Indian food, there's this spice they use. It's called hing, or asafoetida in Latin, which means something fetid, something. And you smell it; it smells really awful. It smells like, you know, really, really bad.
Is it fermented?
I'm not sure if it's fermented or not, but what it is it's the dried sap of the fennel plant, of an Indian fennel plant. And what they do is it looks like sort of like a really crummy amber, you know, and they grate it into a little powder, or sometimes you can buy it grated, but then it's lost some potency. But then they put it in bean and lentil dishes to kind of help with the gaseous effect.
Oh.
Because it helps you digest them, because it's fennel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Digest it. And somehow, magically, when it's cooked in the dish, it gives it a flavor, and you know that's what it is, because if you don't put it in, it doesn't have that flavor, which is nothing like what it smelled. It's a unique, wonderful kind of back note.
Let's talk more about gas and beans. Does this really help with the gas? And people ask me all the time, you know, and I know the common response is to soak your beans, rinse the water, drain the water, put new water, and people, you know, follow all these rules and they still have gas.
Well, my question is, what else are they eating? You know, because since I stopped eating animal products, especially I think the dairy, I have had virtually no problem. None. And I was not that way before, to put it mildly. My wife, you know, was always like, "Oy." And even the sweat doesn't apparently smell as bad as you used to.
Yeah.
And I don't snore. She's never like hit me with an elbow in the middle of the night. You know, there's a lot of benefits to, you know, changing. Not just it's not about what you don't eat. It's about what you do eat.
Well. I've been eating clean food for a long time, and I have to confess that I still snore.
Well, yes.
But I'm perfect.
That's right. You're just the way you are.
That's perfect snoring.
Yeah.
I think I just live in a filthy city environment, and my nose rebels against it.
Well, that's very possible. I mean, I think we all snored when we lived in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
My son had asthma.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't
all
have
right.
it anymore. Or if he does, it's in remission or whatever you call it.
Then I think in our quest to get people back in the kitchen making their own food, people have to know that not only are they perfect as a human, but some of the things that they try are not going to, that may not turn out as they expected. And you have to just keep trying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does help to have
a good recipe
a cookbook that you know that you know that every recipe has been tried and it works. Sometimes they don't do that. Sometimes they just fire it off and it doesn't always work.
Oh, please, I know that.
Books like that. And then some by some insecure chefs whom I will not name that purposely make it vague so you'll never be able to cook like them. And I think that's just insane, but it happens.
Oh, yeah, I've heard people intentionally leave out an ingredient or two so you don't get their secret.
Or they don't really, they're not very clear. I mean, there's one, and I won't say his name, but he was a French chef, and I tried to follow his book when I was learning.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, you know, and then I saw him on TV, and he says, you know, and then add a cup of wine, and he pours like half a bottle. And, you know, and I said, oh, that's how he does his recipes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they don't work. He doesn't care, because he doesn't want you to cook like him.
Right.
Only he is the expert. And that's insane. Because no one will ever be able to reproduce what you do, even if they follow your recipe exactly. So they're going to do something that's going to be a little bit different, and that's good.
Back to that carrot and Madras curry story that I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
We just ate this dish, and what happened was I started out with carrots, and I belong to this organic delivery service, and in the juice box they've been giving me 5 pounds of carrots every week, and I don't like to put carrots in my juice, so we've been having like too many carrots. And I've made this big, before leaving for California, I cooked all these carrots, made this big puree, and then I had this wonderful frozen yellow pepper puree that I had picked up at the food expo in New York a few months ago, and I defrosted that and put it together and added a little soy milk. And it was just a very simple soup puree thing, like baby food almost. And I thought, okay, this is boring, but okay. And then I discovered that Madras curry, and I added it to that concoction, and I loved it. But I had a lot of it.
Carrot puree.
Yeah, and then we froze it because we're leaving, and I just defrosted it, and we had a bunch of leftovers, like rice, a little ratatouille, and this carrot, I want to say carrot slop, but this carrot.
Puree. Puree
carrot
sounds
puree.
Much more enticing than slop.
Puree de carotte, and
and
we put it all together, and it made this, like what were we calling it, a chowder, it was just phenomenal. So the point is that food you can make a dish, and over the course of a few days or weeks, it can turn into something really amazing. Just give it a chance. Play with it.
Yeah, yeah. Even if it doesn't work the first time, keep at it.
All right, keep at it. Okay, I noticed something. I didn't find any wheat or gluten products in your cookbook.
Well, it says on the inside flap, every recipe is gluten-free.
Oh, well, I was looking at
and
the PDF.
And there's something else you might have noticed. Something else you might have noticed in absence of?
Mm-hmm.
Tofu.
Oh, there was no tofu.
I did a search when I was done just to see. I was curious. I wonder how many recipes I did with tofu. There wasn't a single one. I was just, you know, creating recipes and doing cooking.
That's funny.
And I'm not particularly a fan of tofu. I don't dislike it. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I usually, when I cook it, I always do it in a Asian context because I feel like that's where it really shine.
Belongs.
That's where it came from, and it does really well there with spicy sauces to, you know, soak up and do things with. But that was surprising. There's something extraordinary about that. A vegan cookbook with
it is extraordinary because, well, you do have. I want to mention you do have soy in your recipes. You have a tempeh crouton recipe,
right,
which
there's
is
tempeh
genius.
And there's soy sauce and there's miso.
Jesus, genius! Tempeh croutons. I love that idea.
Well, thank you. Genius. Yeah, thank you. That was a compliment. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. I was trying to stick that in there. I have an exclamation point next to my notes here. Tempeh croutons. Yes. And, you know, soy gets this bad name from time to time. I think minimally processed soy foods, organic, non-genetically modified, are fine, and people have been eating them for centuries. And they
especially fermented. Fermented changes a lot.
That's why you don't like tofu.
No, I don't mind it. It's very bland stuff. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have to do something with it to make it. You know, it's like in Indian food, they have paneer. You know, the homemade cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And by itself, it's kind of bland. It doesn't really have any.
Right.
But you put it in a spicy dish where it starts soaking up those juices, and it's incredible. Of course, they have to fry it first. And
let's talk about miso for a moment.
Okay.
Take a miso break. We're now going to take a break and talk about miso. I love miso. Now, one of the issues I have with miso is I really try and avoid salt in my recipes, and you can't get miso without salt. And so I
don't add any after that. Then you don't have to add any salt after. You know, if you make
something with miso. I in general don't add salt to my recipes. They're bland and not bland. They have flavor from quality ingredients and herbs and spices, but I tend to stay away from salt, except when I use miso, and then there's obviously some salt in my recipes. But there are different kinds of misos.
That's right. Some are saltier than others.
And some are saltier than others, and I think that's an important point, because when I go to an Asian store, for example, even the organic ones are super salty.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a particular brand, but I like.
I like the mellow white miso for recipes, because it's you know, unobtrusive. It doesn't really. It doesn't. There are no little bits, and it's not very dark. Doesn't add a lot of color. Or brown rice miso. That's kind of nice. It's a little dark, but. Yeah, I mean, I like the ones that don't add too much of that intense, dark kind of.
You don't like barley misos and.
I like it, but I don't try to. I use it specifically for some things, but not for recipes. And also, I think it's easier for people if they only have to go and buy one kind. In the course of using the book, that they only really have to get one kind. So if
sure,
if they're new to this, it's really easy to find. And
I can imagine those who are new to it. All these different ingredients can be really overwhelming. But the beautiful thing about miso is it pretty much lasts forever.
Yeah, well, it's fermented.
And
keep it covered so it doesn't dry out, but other than that.
Yeah, I keep it in the refrigerator, and I recently discovered South River miso.
Yeah, that's nice stuff.
And it's pricey.
Yeah.
Misos are pricey.
Yeah.
But they do have some phenomenal flavors.
Yeah, with the chickpea one?
Yeah. And I can't eat it right out of the jar, although I do taste a little bit of it because it's salty. But really good
stuff.
Very
high salt tolerance. I can spread it on my toast and just,
All right. A couple of other recipes I wanted to mention in the book. Essene bread. Now, this isn't the first time you've talked about essene bread.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite a lovely little product, and doesn't have any wheat in it.
Doesn't have any. Well, the essene bread did. I mean, what they used back, and this was back, you know, in the time of Jesus.
The biblical essene.
Supposedly,
bread.
I mean, this is from the Essene Gospel of Peace, where Jesus gives the people of his time a few health tips. And one of the things he did was he gave a recipe for essene bread. Told them how to make it, and you just sprout the seeds, the wheat berries, and then. Once they're sprouted, you grind them up, and then you just pat them together into a little cake, and then he would put it on a hot rock. Since, you know, I don't live in the Middle East. I live in Colorado. I use a very, very low oven.
You could find some hot rocks in Colorado.
I'd have to heat them myself.
Yeah.
At this point. In the summer, they could get pretty hot, but nothing like, you know, I mean, I could take them out to Death Valley to bake them, but meh. But just do it in a low oven, and then you're retaining most of the nutrients, especially the mixture that's on in the inside of the loaf, because they're not really, you know, it's not something you can make a sandwich out of. It's a little bit gooey and a little bit chewy and very chewy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can slather it with some almond butter and some of that fig jam that's in the book.
Right. I wanted to talk about that next. How did you know?
Okay. Well, I won't ruin it. But but what I've done is I've taken it in a direction of the nutrient dense kind of thing, and I use quinoa and buckwheat and brown rice. Brown rice doesn't really sprout because it doesn't have all the stuff in it. But it gets tender, and when you blend it up, it makes a nice paste. And then I also put sunflower seeds and walnuts and grated carrot and.
Does it not really sprout because it's heat flashed or something before?
I don't know what they do
shifts.
To it, but it doesn't sprout.
Yeah,
it definitely doesn't sprout.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sunflower seeds look like they're sprouting, but they don't really sprout. I mean, they get the little germ that kind of sticks out.
Yeah.
But it won't grow into a sunflower seed sprout because it doesn't have the husk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it totally begins to sprout. I mean, it gets the two halves spread open, and you get this little. Them, but that's as far as it ever goes. They'll rot long before anything else would happen.
Now, I sprout sunflower seeds from time to time, but I get them from a special place, and they come in the black
right.
They're covering.
Yeah, they're shelled. And like when you see sunflower sprouts in the store, a lot of times there'll be that little thing, like a little mussel shell clamped onto some of them that didn't come off.
Right. And those are the most delicious sprouts in the entire world, I have to say, sunflower sprouts.
Okay. Well,
love
if you
them.
Say, I'm very fond of them. I didn't think of calling them the most delicious in the world. I don't know.
Of all sprouts, do you have a favorite sprout?
I like the microgreens, which are kind of like sprouts, although they're growing.
Sunflower sprouts were that kind of thing that when I put them in my mouth one of the very first times, it made me stop and notice them.
Mm. That's
it was
true.
One of those moments.
Pea shoots.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah. I like anything that's just growing. It's fantastic. My body loves green.
Yeah, me too. Jam fig. Fig jam.
Jam fig.
In our quest to get people back into the kitchen, and people are really kicking and screaming for the most part. Most people don't want to get into their kitchen. They're tired. They've got too much to do. They don't really see the obvious benefits until somebody coerces them to get into the groove of making their own food.
I have a friend who took out her kitchen. She had a contractor come and just remove everything and make it into a room of some kind. She doesn't have a kitchen at all. Does not have a kitchen.
That's too funny.
Eats out always.
That's sad.
Scary.
Now, I don't know which is worse, not having a kitchen or having the most gorgeous kitchen with all of the best, all clad and Creuset and all the lovely...
And all in pristine condition
because
nobody ever
uses it. And never touch any of it. Which is worse?
I've worked in kitchens that were like that, where I walk in and I go, wow, this is great. And you realize they've never used it.
I've done that too. It's... Yeah. But maybe not having a kitchen is more honest. But then when you ultimately do want to find your kitchen, you're going to have to rebuild it. But I'm not going to worry about that.
No, we don't have to worry about this person. She's not.
You know, I don't know about you, but I have managed to make wonderful meals with one electric burner and one pot.
Yeah.
I don't need a kitchen.
No, you don't need one. It's nice to have one, but
it's nice.
Yeah. You can make two, and also now that I, you know, unless I'm working for a millionaire who eats animal products, I don't need but two knives, a long one, you know, chef knife and a paring knife, and that's all I need.
That's a really good point.
I don't need a boning knife. I don't need a filleting knife. I don't need
right.
a clam opening knife. I don't need.
I suppose those knives might come in handy for specific purposes with certain foods, but pretty much, two knives will do it. Big one and a little one.
Yeah. Sometimes a serrated one if you want to cut bread or
tomatoes. Oh, yeah, serrated.
If your knife gets dull and you need to cut a tomato, you can use a serrated.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe three or four knives. Anyway.
I still have them. I just don't need them.
So there's a lot of jellies and jams out on the market, and now we've moved towards the availability of having jellies and jams without sugar. They're fruit juice sweetened pretty much. Mm-hmm. But I discovered making my own from dried fruit, and it's the easiest thing, and I just do it with water and dried fruit. I do it with apricots. I do it with prunes. It's the most incredible, delicious thing, and you're just one notch up by using port instead of water. Oh, my goodness.
Making it just a little bit extraordinary.
Yes. Wow.
Doesn't take much.
That sounds...
And I also add a little vanilla bean, you might have noticed.
Okay, vanilla bean too, but the port...
It's optional, but I recommend it.
Yeah, delicious. So it's actually sweetened with grape juice, because that's what port is, right?
Right, yeah. And, it's also, and port is also a little more... It's fortified, so it's got a little kick to it.
Yeah. I mean, why not? And it's not hard to make. It really isn't.
No. The hard part is just cutting off the little stem end. Everything else is just so easy.
It's so easy. So I can't encourage people enough to try these things. And the thing is, just like anything, we're already perfect, as Alan has told us, but practice makes us perfecter.
Well, there's two sides to the perfect. We're not perfect in the sense that everything we do comes out right. We're not perfect in the sense that we never make mistakes. It's just that when you see that... We are the perfect vehicle for this consciousness. We are the perfect machine for living to the fullest. No other creature can get as much out of life as we can. And we have a very short time to do it. And if we apply ourselves, we can really, really enjoy life. And that's the whole point. This is why we're here. We're hardwired for this. So in that sense, we're perfect. We're the perfect machine for accomplishing that purpose. And then we screw up, but that's, and we get inconvenienced by other people. We go, well, in a perfect world, you know, as describing a world that would be just perfect for us. The lights always turn green as we approach. Everyone else stops, you know. But that's not perfection. That's convenience.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice, though? Walking in my neighborhood here in Forest
Hills. Yeah,
unless
you're one of the people coming the other way, and they have to wait for you to go by. It wouldn't be so perfect for them, would it?
No, but I would like to see a little more politeness. And
move to a small town.
Are they really more polite in a small town?
They are. They're not as harried as people in a big city are. They're not as on a tight schedule. They're not freaking out about the minor things.
Freaking out about the minor things. And it's all about paying attention. We talked about attention as the currency of love. Paying attention everywhere is so important.
So that's the way farmers used to farm. They didn't have devices to know what the, you know, they had to pay attention to the air currents and the way the clouds were forming and what the earth felt like and the smell of the air. So, it smells like rain. It smells like, you know.
Well, actually, some of those skills are coming back into fashion with the biodynamic type of agriculture. And there's a lot of things that we haven't figured out with high tech that the old-fashioned techniques really are helpful, where people really become so sensitive to the life all around them, the life in the soil, the life in the air, the life in the water. Talking to the plants or just knowing what they're feeling, paying attention. Attention.
Well, this is. I mean, you know, when you think about it, what is the one thing people want more than anything else? They want to feel good. You know, and if you stop paying attention, you're not going to feel as good because your receptors are just dull.
It's you have to put in to get out.
That's right.
All right, let's talk about pistachios for a moment. I don't see pistachios very often in recipes. They're super delicious, and they're absolutely stunning on poached pears.
They are, aren't they? You notice that?
Yes, stunning picture.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love making very simple poached pears. Just poaching them in water is fabulous, but any addition. And again, it's like knowing the right things that'll go with it. You can flavor the water with a variety of things, but you have some very lovely recipes and pistachios. Mm.
Yeah, did you see the pistachio crust on the fig tart?
I did. Again,
yeah. That's gluten-free.
Pistachios need a little more press. They're really quite good. Why don't we see enough of them?
I think people just don't know that they can, I guess. They think it's ice cream and that's it.
Right.
And they think of it as a bright green ice cream, unnaturally green.
Yeah, exactly.
Because when I make pistachio ice cream, it's very pale green.
Yeah. Well,
actually, the base of the absinthe ice cream is pistachios added to it for the green color. And it really goes well. The flavor of pistachio goes really well with the flavor of absinthe.
All right. We just have a few minutes left, so let's
really?
Talk
wow.
more about... I know, we can babble all day, can't we?
I know.
Let's talk a little bit more about Alan Roediger and your websites and your blogs and events and services and everything you're up to.
Well, I'm moving away from Cooking for Millionaires and moving towards helping the average person learn how to cook and do this because I think it's important. And I like normal people, average people, more than rich and famous people. They're much more available. They're much more...
appreciative?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not always. I mean, there are some that are very appreciative, but usually it's, you know, I'm paying you, and that's all I need to do. But also, here's an improvement over last time we spoke. I do have one website now, and it's just alanroediger.com, and I have my blog is going to be on there. I'm still working on setting this up, and people can sign up for my newsletter there, and they can access, they can send me an email or whatever, and discuss what kind of options I have as far as coaching and consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And in cooking classes, I have to figure out a way to make them universally available. Right now it's just me in front of people, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy the direct contact with people. But I want to make this available to everyone. I want to teach basic knife skills, everything, so that you can get good. Here's a cool thing. When you do something, when you practice a skill, you acquire a skill, you automatically want to practice it more because you can. It's something about, look what I can do. Right. It goes back to, look, what I'm doing. And then the more you practice it, the better you get. And when you get really good, then you really want to practice because it feels great to be good at something. And then you do practice it enough, it becomes second nature, and then you can do it without even thinking. And that's what I'm aiming for. I want people to feel like they can go into the kitchen and make something without a recipe, without anything. Just walk in because they know, because they've learned. And then it's beautiful. Then people are enjoying their life.
And, you know, people that have studied culinary arts for thousands of years now, I think we've come to a point where there are some things that when done in a certain way, they're easier, more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to, I mean, why reinvent the wheel?
And oh, I just know learn how it turns.
What?
Just learn how to use it. That's all.
Well, I mean, for example, I never had any culinary training, and I kind of figured things out on my own, and I had my own way of doing things, and that worked fine. And now my partner, Gary, he has trained in the culinary arts, and sometimes he'll, you know, say, why are you doing it that way?
Don't do it that way.
Do it this way. But, you know, some of the things I've learned from him are really amazing, and I'm glad I've learned them because they work better. And now I'm not chopping my fingers off, you know?
Oh, yeah, don't chop your fingers off. You have a weapon in that other hand. Be careful.
Right. Anyway, so there's value to that. And people love watching people cook. We know how popular the food shows on mm-hmm. Food Network and other networks are. And we really do need more venues and opportunities to learn how to make healthy food, not just any kind of food, and
right.
make it.
How to make healthy food that is really good.
That was really good. Makes your mouth water. I know we're on the same path, Alan. The food that we make is beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's full of love. It's good for the planet. It's good for our bodies. It makes us feel good. And underline delicious, delicious, delicious. It is delicious.
We have taste buds for a reason.
Oh, we do?
It's not a mistake. Totally, totally not a mistake.
We're not gulping this food down and, yeah.
Well, I'm not. I take the longest to eat of anybody in my family. I always have.
Now, what do you do when you're traveling and eating?
I take my trail mix with me.
You have a recipe for trail mix in your book.
Yeah. It's my.
It's like a high-powered trail mix.
Because I use goji berries and mulberries and dried blueberries and currants.
Here's an example. Trail mix, okay? There's lots of different trail mixes in the stores. And why do you want to make your own trail mix? It's not hard.
Fresher.
It's fresher. You don't have preservatives. Sometimes they add all kinds of stuff.
And you can get the dried fruit without sugar. It doesn't need it.
And you can mix the stuff you like together. Now, I think every home should have a variety of raw nuts and seeds because they're good for you. Sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, mm-hmm. walnuts, mm-hmm. almonds, cashews. You should have all of these and keep them in your refrigerator and eat them all the time. They're delicious. They're good for you. And then you throw them together.
People ask you where you get your protein, well, there it is.
There it is. There's one place anyway.
And one place, yeah.
And then when you're ready for, you're going to travel, I mean, it's a great airplane food to throw a bag of that together and have it on the airplane. And it's so good. And, you want to get a little decadent. You add a little dark chocolate chips in there.
There's nothing decadent about that. That's good for you. It's got flavonoids and compounds that are good for your heart and your brain and everything.
Nothing decadent. It's all good
food.
As long
as it doesn't have a lot of sugar in it, you get the 70% or above. I use a 71%. Little chip, and it's not the kind of chips you put in chocolate cookies, because those are formulated to not melt.
Mm.
This is just pure dark chocolate.
Well, Alan, I like to end on a very sweet note, and that's what we're doing here. But we're at the end, and thank you for joining me. This was so much fun. So thanks for being an extraordinary vegan and for writing the Extraordinary Vegan Cookbook. All the best to you, and let's meet for dinner sometime.
New York, probably.
All
right.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. I'm Karen Hartglass. We've come to an end of It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And remember, have a delicious week.